Hello, my name is Bernadette Russell. Welcome to episode 8 of How to Be Hopeful, a podcast all about how to find hope and how to keep hold of it once you've found it. This week, the subject is death, a difficult, frightening subject for many of us, and something that it might be high time we spent a little bit more time thinking and talking about, as difficult as that can seem at times. I wanted to broach this subject as I think it's a big one. I think it's unavoidable and something that we all experience, and something that perhaps we've felt closer to us in recent weeks than ever before. But don't worry, it's going to be, surprisingly enough, fun, because I'm lucky enough to be joined by Lucy Nichols and Antonia Beck, friends and colleagues and artists, who I was lucky enough to make a fantastic show about death with, based on their extensive and intensive research of the subject. The show was aptly called The Death Show. But before we go on to that and that conversation, here's a tiny little taster of the show.
Tell me, what is the meaning of life and also the purpose of death?
Ooh. So, without further ado, and with the hope of getting some of the answers to those very pertinent questions, let's have a listen to Antonia and Lucy and what they had to say about death and about hope. Could you both tell me your names and how you both are at this very moment?
Do you want to go first?
That wasn't helpful. Lucy, go.
Hi, Bernadette. I'm Lucy, and how I am right at this moment is probably pretty good, quite reflective, I think. It's literally just saying to Antonia about what a strange time it is. And it's good to remind ourselves that it's okay to be finding it quite difficult at points.
Absolutely. It's really important to be able to be honest. And
yes, so I'm Antonia. Hello. And I'm feeling pretty positive today as well. This is the first week where I feel like I can genuinely say I've been feeling more positive. So, yes, so it's really nice to be able to say that out loud, that I'm feeling positive.
Oh, good. Well, we'll get on to the current apocalypse soon. But first of all, just to go back a little bit, when we recently worked together, that was on The Death Show. And I just wondered if you could both, I know it's difficult because you're not in the same room as each other, so don't worry about talking over each other, that's cool. But if you could both explain a little bit about what that was or what that is.
So, yes, so The Death Show was, I guess, yeah, how we all sort of started working together. The Death Show is a theatre show that we all created, which was essentially sort of an exploration of, I guess, our collective, but I guess mainly Lucy and my experiences of, our thoughts about end of life and death and our sort of shared and different experiences and anxieties around that. I mean, the reason we wanted to make a show about death was because we both knew that we had this fear of death, and it's something we spoke about a lot over the years. And we got to the point where we said, yeah, why don't we see if we can make a show about this? Because, you know, there will be other people who can hopefully relate to our experiences. And we thought it would be, yeah, it would be something interesting to make a show about. So, so that's how we got started, really. We got some money from the Arts Council to undertake quite a lot of research around end of life and death. We really sort of threw ourselves into that world to try and find out as much as possible about what happens, how you can what kind of funerals you can organise and arrange. We looked at sort of the spiritual and religious side of death and end of life as well. And we took all of that, all of that material back into the rehearsal room. And then we worked with you, Bernadette, on crafting it into a beautiful show. So.
Yeah, well, I'm going to, it'll be nice to, at the end to let people know how to sort of connect with that and your work. But I just want to say at this juncture as well, you two are hilarious and deliver it hilariously, which is no sort of mean feat, really, considering that you weren't there. You know, you really, you know, you literally saw a body being burnt in a crematorium. You handled a dead body. You were courageous. I think it's really important that everyone knows that. And it was hilarious. And it included, you know, you made a song and dance about it, literally, which was really nice. So we'll go back to that, because it'd be nice for people to know how to access that should they wish to. But Lucy, if I could just turn to you for a little bit, and obviously, as Antonia's touched on, you went through quite a process in the making and the researching of it, and this is a big question, which might feel sort of quite like a big one to answer on a Thursday at 5 o'clock, but I wondered if for you personally that process changed your attitude towards death and dying, and made it different in any way, and if so, how?
Yeah, it was an extensive research process. As you mentioned, quite a lot of hands-on experience. We were artists in residence at Undertakers. We looked into sort of being celebrants, did some training around that. It was really varied. We spoke to lots of people who were undertakers, who did death photography, all sorts of people within the death industry. And it was a fascinating process. In terms of whether it's changed my attitude around death, it's hard to say. I feel much better informed, and I feel I would be able to hopefully plan the funeral I would like for myself and for loved ones when that time comes. I feel better prepared around the sort of practical elements of it, but I still feel afraid of death, for sure.
I think it's interesting. It's back, sort of back to what you said earlier about being able to acknowledge the whole range of human emotions and feelings like we're confronted with right now, that I was really interested in the research that you two did. It made me consider things, and I was thinking, actually, even if fear is not removed, because in a way, how can you not be scared of dying? but it may, well, the lesson I learned from you two, and I'm really grateful for learning, that actually informing yourself, going there, when you're scared of something, still saying, but I'm going to find out, is actually beneficial and empowering. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I think so. I guess to kind of acknowledge a fear and then to walk towards it is quite brave. Maybe it didn't feel like that at the time particularly, but in essence, that is what we did. So,
yeah, you really did.
That in of itself is quite interesting, isn't it? I think instead of like walking, yeah, to pull back from it, we very much, confronted it.
You were both really modest about that, actually. And it's only just occurred to me at a little bit of a distance about the degree of courage that it required to do all of the things, but also to confront that fear, which was your shared biggest fear. So it's really admirable, and I think a really good lesson for me to walk towards the abyss with some sparkly trousers on, maybe. I don't know. And Tony, could you talk a little bit about that as well? I know it's a big question, but because I know you two had different experiences, and whether you feel that your attitude towards death and dying is different, having had that experience, both of the research and of the show.
Sure. I would say, even though I do feel better, I guess, about the fact I'm going to die one day, more accepting of that, I'm still not happy about necessarily about the fact that I am going to I'm going to die one day, but I think one of the best things for me that came out of that experience was essentially finding out all this stuff that I didn't know before, and it sort of demonstrated to me how important it is that we do know what our options are, what's available to us, and that we do feel informed and empowered to plan for a good death, if possible. You know, so many of these conversations don't happen until you get to that point at the end of life where you're having to plan for your own funeral imminently, or someone else is planning a funeral, and it's sort of those conversations are almost too late at that point. And so it is, I mean, it just shows how important it is for us to have these conversations when we're healthy, when we're in good places, and to have that with people that we love and we trust. Yeah,
that makes so much sense, because I know both of you have sort of spoken to me about this previously as well. It makes a lot of sense to me that the wrong time to address those things is in the midst of a crisis, when you're feeling awful and everything's extreme. I heard you mention sort of a good death. Is that what you mean? Sort of well prepared and as comfortable as can be. Is that?
Yes, and of course, you know, we've got we've got no control over whether that will actually happen or not. But if we can put plans in place for, you know, little things like, you know, making a will or deciding what you might like for your funeral, whether it's what music you might like played or something read, or you know, whether you want to be cremated or buried or another option. Essentially that a funeral is not just for you, it's obviously for the people that you leave behind as well, and it just helps to take, it seems like it takes a little bit of that pressure off people who are already going through a very difficult time, to know that they have your plan or your wishes already in hand, and they can execute them as you know you would have wanted, I guess. We talked to a number of funeral directors who, you know, frequently commented on the fact that they see so many families arguing and this extra pressure because they never had those conversations, and you know, one person thinks they know what's best, and then another person saying, but that's not what they wanted, and so it just helps that. Yeah, what's obviously going to be quite a difficult time.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you were talking, I thought it's part of compassionate practice, isn't it? It's just a way of taking care of people around that. So now I'm afraid I'm going to have to address the current pandemic, which is in all of our faces and in some of our homes. And actually, I was going to say it'd be nice to come back to you at some point in the future after this and sort of talk about death in a different way. But I wanted to speak to you, Lucy, just a little bit about how I'm sort of aware, and I've been thinking about you two a lot actually, about how now death and dying is right in our faces. It's very present, it's literally in the news every day, you know, numbers, in terms of numbers and in terms of stories. And I wondered if, Lucy, first of all, if you think the pandemic has changed the conversation or attitude towards death and dying, and if so, how? I mean, you might not, but just wondered if you do.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's, as we were just saying, the best time to be making plans and to having those conversations actually isn't when it's imminent. I suppose there's something for me of a little bit of a similarity to having a birth plan, particularly thinking about those as two really seminal things that will happen within your life. With a birth plan, you make arrangements and you think about the way you would like it to be, and you acknowledge that those things won't necessarily happen. You won't necessarily get to have the birth that you want, but you still make arrangements and presume that you can make certain choices, hopefully, at some point. So there's some parallels, I think, there. And I think during a epidemic possibly isn't the best time to be thinking about the practicalities. But if it's shining a light on it for people, then it is a good time, if it's not been done before, to make some plans and to have some conversations. It is difficult, I think, though, within the situation where it feels very, very real. The fear is very real and legitimate. So that changes the nature of the conversation, and it changes its urgency, and it makes it probably a harder one to initiate for people.
Well, it's interesting, Lucy, because I was wondering whether actually, and this is about my personal experience, so I've not done a scientific analysis of this, but because we are in
as my friend Stella brilliantly said yesterday, we're in the same sea in different boats. So because we're in the same sea, that we are all possibly looking at someone we know dying, or we're worried about people being frail or vulnerable. I was just thinking, I wonder if that makes the conversation more possible, because it's a shared experience. And obviously death's always a shared experience, but it feels that now that vulnerability, everybody's got, is either vulnerable themselves or might know someone, and whether that could make the conversation, might make it more everyday in a way.
I'm not sure. There's a certain amount of magic that's attributed to death. So if you talk about it, you're potentially willing it to happen, or it's jinxing something, or it's a bad omen, or I'm not sure. But there's things, there's magic around death and around its discussion. So I wonder, for some people, is it potentially making it harder at the moment? I don't know. I'm not sure what the answer is to that. I think it makes it more immediate, and it makes it maybe more necessary. But whether it makes it easier, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it might be. It's just too soon. We're right here with it, aren't we? It's right in our faces. So it might just be too soon to work those things out. Sorry, Antonio, were you going to say?
I did see a news headline last week about there being a bit of a surge in online death cafes recently. Sort of across the world, I thought that was quite interesting, because, as you say, death is very, very prominent, and so people are suddenly realizing that they need a space to talk about it. And I guess what's one of the great things that's come out of this pandemic is re-engaging with, or using technology in different ways, or using technology in the way that we didn't realise we could. And so, I've been hearing about death cafes happening over Zoom and Skype and things like that. So
could you just explain what death cafes are, just in case somebody's not aware?
Sure, yeah. So the death cafe movement was set up by a man called John Underwood. And he basically decided to create a space, an open, agendaless space where people could come together as a small group to talk about death and dying. Tea and cake is usually a big part of those conversations. But yeah, since he set that up in the UK, it's now become a global movement happening all over the place. And there is a website, if you Google Death Cafe, that their website will come up, and you can see where death cafes are taking place. I don't know how up to date it is in terms of the virtual death cafes, but it's the idea that it's not a counselling session. It is about having an open conversation without an agenda.
That's amazing.
And I wonder as well, with the take up of those, are people talking about their preparations? Are they talking about their fear, or are they talking about grief as well? Which,
yes,
it's something Antonia and I, during our research, were quite mindful of acknowledging, but not excavating, really, because it felt like death was a big enough subject as it was.
Yeah, absolutely. So, it feels like it's a whole other jar, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Because I spoke to David Harradine, who I think you both know. He and I have spoken quite a lot about grief, and made the decision, if you like, the other flip side of the coin of your decision, to deal with grief rather than deal with death, because they're both sort of really huge. But certainly I've been aware that there's a lot more grief around, and that is just not just grief attached to death and dying, but grief attached to other kinds of loss.
Yeah.
And again, circling back to what I think it was Lucy, what you said earlier about the importance of acknowledging all of the things we're feeling, and that they're different, and some days it's grief for lost opportunities or whatever. Yet Stella, who I spoke to yesterday, Stella Duffy, she is studying psychotherapy at the moment. Do you two know Stella Duffy?
I've met her.
Yeah. So she's now studying psychotherapy, amazingly. She was talking to me, and coincidentally I'd written about it in the book, about Sisyphus. Do you know the myth of Sisyphus? He's the bloke that kept rolling the rock up the hill and it kept rolling back down. He's a sort of emblem of existentialism and a Greek god or semi-god, I remember, and sort of is cited in existential philosophy as being representing the sort of meaninglessness of life. So he's a really cheerful chap. Well, I don't know, he might have been cheerful, but he's not such cheerful things get attached to him. So that's quite interesting. And a lot of people during the, whilst I was excavating hope, a lot of people mentioned Sisyphus in terms of despair. And he's particularly attached to philosophy around death, because it's like, how, in the face of the certainty of death, how is hope possible? That's a massive question that I did try to sort of talk about in the chapter that I spoke with both of you about. And I wondered if you, I know it's a massive sort of ask and question, but I just wondered if you, if both of you had any thoughts about that, if you think that hope can have any place, given that we know that death is inevitable. Because I've got quite strong feelings about that, but I'm not an existentialist.
I think it's probably the fact that time, that life is finite and that time is limited, that makes life meaningful. So I don't see death as an enemy of hope at all, no. But I think that if life was continuous and lasted for eternity, and I don't even really know what eternity is, but, you know, was, had no end, was, it would be hard to find meaning, I think.
Yeah, I think so as well. And I also, I mean, I said it slightly facetiously to the philosopher I was talking to, but I said to him, Sisyphus might have been enjoying himself. He might have been the sort of person that likes repetitious tasks. He might have really enjoyed working out. He might have enjoyed the view. You know, he might have thought, do you know what? This is pointless, but what the heck? Which in a way is what we all do. When sometimes I find it really comforting to think of us all as sort of idiots, if you know what I mean. Kind of fools, you know, smiling fools. And that's okay. That we just try to get the pleasure that we can, as you said, Lucy, from the small time you've got. And I want, just circling back to your brilliant show, I think one of the things that you two did really well was excavate that, the sort of beauty in small everyday pleasures, which counters that, doesn't it? It sort of counters that kind of miserabilist sort of, there's no point if it's all going to end anyway. It sounds like you almost think the opposite of that, Lucy.
I think so.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that life doesn't sometimes seem devoid of meaning, for sure. There's times when it feels like a rough scramble in the dark. You know, and it's not a rehearsal and all that, but it does feel like you're endlessly trying to find the lines or remember what show you're doing and why you're on stage and what your blocking is and lots of other theatre analogies.
They're working though, all of them. What about you, Antonio? What do you think of Sisyphus and his?
Yes, because didn't he? That was his punishment, wasn't it?
Yes,
tried to cheat death or something. Was
he
that
was punished by the gods? But I don't think it was cheating death. It's terrible because I've just read it. But basically, he was punished, and his task was he rolled a rock up to the top of the hill, and as soon as he got, which was when he was going to be released from it, and as soon as he got to the top, it rolled back down again, and he did that for eternity, which is ages.
Yeah, yeah. I would definitely agree with a lot of what you were saying, Lucy, there. I mean, hope is so important. And I think in terms of trying to find maybe hope sort of enables us to keep trying, just to keep going, no matter how small or big that is, just to carry on in some form. Because I mean, death is huge. It's you know, and something we talk about in the show is you know, we've been trying to find this meaning of life, meaning of death, and it's enormous. It was an impossible task trying to find that meaning. So we felt it was about taking it back to what you know and what gives you meaning, whether that's you know, petting a nice dog or writing a book or creating a podcast or you know, other big achievements. It's what's meaningful to you, what gives you purpose, what gives you value, and through that that can help, that gives you that sort of that meaningful for life, and which feels really hopeful. So I would say that statement that you said, Lucy, about death not being the enemy of hope, I think that's really true.
It's true, and you both have mentioned something to me before about purpose, which I think is really interesting, and certainly in conversation with you and watching you both work, one of the really strong takeaway for me was the pursuit of having a purpose, whether that's grand or small, feels sort of more important than the pursuit of happiness, which is perhaps a little bit vaguer. Not that, what I mean is that I always got the impression that it's about, if you try to pursue a purpose, you might be happy as a side of it, but that it's good to try and just pursue having a purpose, whether that purpose be, I'm going to go and see some monkeys in the zoo, or I'm going to try and get my show on the road. Do you think that striving for a purpose and setting out to achieve something could pull somebody out of feeling hopeless?
Possibly. I think we're all probably searching for meaning, and reflecting on what that is for us. There's a Japanese word that I can't remember, and it's about kind of where, what you're good at, what you, I'm not articulating this very well. It's a word that's kind of about what you're good at, mm-hmm. and where you can flourish, and mm-hmm. what your skills are and what you enjoy. And it's kind of this center point between several things. And at this point is you're at your peak, I suppose, or you're feeling most fulfilled. And I think sometimes we gain a lot through just feeling useful, I think, whether yes. that's serving our own interest to be happy, or I think for a lot of us, it's about serving a higher purpose, or at least a civic duty, or to serve others. That feels more meaningful.
Yeah, I'm quite influenced. I've just read Man's Search for Meaning. Have either of you read that? It's absolutely fantastic. So it's by a gentleman called Viktor Frankl, and he was in a concentration camp. He's a Jewish psychologist. He was in a concentration camp during the Second World War when he was able, thankfully, to survive that experience, but also keep his eye on it as a scientist and help people thrive afterwards. And I'm still reading the book, but he talks a lot about finding meaning even in suffering, because obviously they were facing death, the possibility of death every day. So he had to try and excavate, how do we carry on? He was talking about the people that just gave up and would just sort of sit there defeated, obviously with good reason, and how you, and I was quite interested in that. That is an extreme situation, of course, but interesting that he was facing death every day, and he took that on and thought, okay, how can I find meaning in this? And he talks a lot about purpose, and in his work afterwards, he helped a lot of his clients find purpose, as you said, Lucy, the higher power fit, or higher purpose, to serve something bigger than yourself. So I think that's really interesting, and I think it relates to now, because I think I'm aware from my sister that there's a big sort of uptick in mental health challenges for people, And that some of that, again, according to conversations with my sister, is about people having felt they've lost their purpose, like they can't see their purpose because they're kind of twiddling around, you know, not able to do anything. And I think in the what's helping us to serve that at the moment, and something I wanted to talk to you both about as artists, is art, the sort of creative response that's happened during this pandemic. And in relation to that, I just wondered if you thought that art and creativity, art in its broadest sense, as well as helping people practically in the moment, giving them things to do and means of expression, that art in its broadest sense is a useful way of discussing things like death and dying and disease and other taboos. Because obviously you did it with your theatre show, but I wondered if you think that art can serve that, getting rid of those kind of taboos, and if so, how?
Yes, I think yes. I mean, I think we would both say that yes, art has a huge role to play in addressing all of the things you described and everything else. I guess to break it down, you know, we talk about art being an opportunity for the world to be reflected back on an audience, and for audiences or participants or artists as well to create and take part in a shared experience, which can be really, really enriching. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of difficulties and a lot of barriers with art, as well as we all know. But it's certainly a really important way in which we can tackle some of these taboo topics, such as death. I mean, the fact that, you know, we were able to create and tour a show which was called The Death Show, and very prominently about death and dying, to 17 theatres and art centres around the country, and take that topic quite prominently into a space where it isn't normally, was amazing. And the fact that audiences came and they actually wanted to come and be part of those conversations, and we were providing a space in which that could happen. I mean, that's I think that's what's really inspiring, as well as a maker, that you know, art provides an opportunity to explore something in a different way and present it in a different way and find other routes for people to come and take part.
Yeah, I think it feels as though, again, I keep coming back to this really, but it feels as though there are opportunities that are present at the moment for new conversations or old conversations to happen in a new way, including the conversation about death and grief and all of those other things. And I'm sort of looking forward to it. It's like I said to you, Lucy, it almost feels too soon or too close to tell what positive changes there might be, but that I'm hoping that there are more positive conversations, and that your work and work of other people that are working in these areas are sort of revived as, I mean, literally death rates are much higher than they usually are. So I'm hoping that the conversation stays public and open, and, you know, we have access to all of these things. One of the other things I wanted to talk about was, moving away from death a little bit and a little bit more on the sunny side of the street, I suppose, was I've been very aware that, without diminishing all the sad things that have happened and the loss and the negative feelings and experiences, that this period of time has gifted us things as well, and that it's useful and practical to take note of them. And I wondered, first of all, you, Lucy, if you've had any positive changes that have happened to you since the lockdown, that you'd like to keep for afterwards, or you might like to keep for afterwards.
Yeah, there's been a few. Like, there's been a real connection with where I live, I suppose. So, like, just being at home more, which I've enjoyed, and connecting with my street. We have a very active WhatsApp group It's a lot of street chat. I've never felt so rooted in a place, which is interesting because we only moved into this house end of February.
Wow.
So it's only like, you know, a few weeks or so before it all happened, really. And I've never felt so connected to where I am. And also just, it's hard to say it without sounding a bit trite, but it is noticing the little things. It really is. Like, I like going out to the garden at night or even just early evening, and it's so quiet. I can't hear a car go past. I can't hear anything but some like nature sounds. I can hear birds in the morning really loudly. I've really enjoyed that experience of feeling much more connected to nature. And I think when you're looking for hope, nature's a great source of that, isn't it? Because nature is like, I'm going to keep going no matter what. Like, this isn't going to stop me. Just keeps going. I like it when you walk on the street and you see tree roots that have like ripped apart concrete on the pavement.
So quickly.
Yeah, and I think, oh, such power and such force and such this consistent presence that kind of can't be broken despite everything else feeling chaotic, finding like real reassurance in that as a consistency. And
I thought of you the other day, Lucy, when I saw a film of some sheep that had broken into a children's playground.
Amazing.
And were playing on the merry-go-round. Did you see that, Antonia? And
yes.
It was delightful. Yep. And then I saw a film, you've probably seen this, of these, it looked like drunk teenage goats, but they were just goats. They weren't drunk or teen, I don't know their age, who were just like eating all the hedges in this Welsh village and all of that stuff. Because it's happened so quickly as well, has sort of demonstrated the resilience of nature. It's incredibly hopeful, isn't it?
Yeah. And I find that joyous. And it's, yeah, I think Bernadette, when this sort of first happened, and maybe we had a couple of text message exchange, and you said something like, go and watch dogs, they know how to live. And it's like, I was like, yeah, oh, they totally do. Dogs are going for it. They don't need any excuse. They're loving life.
Yeah, they really do. They know how to party, and birds do. And do you feel, Lucy, obviously, in a way, this is all guesswork and supposition, and it requires sort of feats of optimism. But do you feel that any of that stuff, like the really pleasant sort of community connection, the maybe lessening of pollution, the abundance of nature and our time to spend in nature, do you think it's possible that there's any hope that we could hold on to some of that? And perhaps even that might work might change, like you were saying, enjoying being at home more.
It's hard not to imagine some real significant changes coming out of this. You know, the Second World War saw women in the workplace, it saw the birth of the NHS. You know, it's hard not to imagine some really seismic changes. Now, what they are, you know, we don't know, but it's hard for me to imagine a world where we are expected to kind of go back to the rat race the way it was. I think reasons we were told we couldn't work from home have sort of vanished. There are things to do with work-life balance that I'm not sure people will want to give up in the same way. And certainly for me, I feel like it's going to make me think very differently about travel and about pollution. And I'm thinking a lot more differently about consumption as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, but some of the adverts I see on TV or via social media that are kind of for face creams or for fashion stuff have sort of took on this kind of weird absurdist kind of oh now
I've been like, that's like, you're trying to sell me what?
Yeah, there's been something really really surreal about it that I've just partly because I haven't felt any pressure to conform in any way. I was like, I'm just literally wearing jogging bottoms and slippers all the time, so it's very hard to be too worried about my appearance anyway. But I just think, yeah, that stuff feels so meaningless, and it felt pretty meaningless before, but it now feels absurd.
Yeah, it feels quaint. You know, it feels powerless, quaint, and sort of almost like, oh, look at them. That's almost, it kind of does already belong to another time, and I, like you, I think it sounds like, find find that immensely hopeful, because I hear these conversations over and over and over and over again. I'm also very encouraged in the shift, the seismic tonal shift in the way that news is presented. In the BBC presents, you know, Hero Half Hour, and we hear stories about people, ordinary people, again, with, you know, extraordinary acts of courage, generosity, kindness, instead of hearing awful stories. So that I find that encouraging. Have you noticed that the news is being different, or that?
I mean, I've had I think I've had a less positive experience of the news, and so I think certainly, because I've really cut down the amount of news that I'm consuming now, because I found it was it just wasn't very good for me, basically. I was getting very anxious, but I certainly found that we've had a few weeks where it just feels that the media are grabbing any headline that they can to just get something out. And then I remember there was one day where I can't remember which outlet it was, but you know, they put out a headline in the morning about schools reopening, possibly reopening at the end of May, and then later the education secretary later that day was quoted as saying, "That's not going to happen. There's no way that will happen." That will happen. So for me, it just felt that the news has just been trying to grab what they can in order to keep some kind of conversation going. But so I think, yeah, it's really nice. I mean, I didn't realise about the Hero Hour. So I think maybe I need to be, yeah, if I'm going to start to ease myself back into the world of news, I'd like to do it like that, I think.
Yeah, I've been very selective. I mean, I watch Hero Half Hour every morning, and I've cried. Well, I've cried every day since the 14th of March, and I'm somewhat proud of that. But yes, I watch Hero Half Hour every morning, and it's incredibly moving and real. You know, it's not Pollyanna-ish. These are real things that are really happening every day. And for me, because I've looked out for them for the last 10 years, I've always known they were happening every day. But to see them on primetime news is hugely gratifying. Just to ask you, Antonia, and do add, if you want to add to anything that Lucy said that I haven't asked you, please do. But I'm interested in this because there's been a lot of talk on lots of platforms and on lots of media outlets about going back to normal. And there's been a sort of interesting response to this, quite witty response from a lot of people going, "That I don't want to go back to normal, thank you." Like Lucy was saying, nobody wants to go back to a three-hour commute, for example. So for you, if you could hope for a new normal, if you like, what would be your sort of headlines for a new normal? If that was up to you, Antonia, and you could create the world anew.
Oh, that's a big question.
I
would definitely agree with a lot of what you were saying, Lucy, about some of the really positive things that have come out. I mean, I'm loving going for my walk every day, and it's as if Mother Nature, yes, I mean, like, the weather's never been better, the blossom flowers, I mean, it's just incredible. It's as if Mother Nature knew that when we go out for our hour walks, we would need a little something extra just to keep us going. I guess sort of headline things for me are about that, the fact that the pace has slowed. That has felt good. That's felt really good, because I know I was certainly working at a pace that in the long term is just completely unsustainable. And now I've actually got time to pause and breathe and to think about the work I want to create and what format that now needs to be in. And you know, whilst I've also gone through a bit of a period of grieving for that world that I once was in, now that I've sort of come out of that grief for the moment, I'm thinking about, well, actually this does present a lot of new opportunities, and thinking about, well, going back to some of those big questions about, well, who is the work for and how do people engage with it? And particularly in terms of socially engaged practice, it's just, yeah, there's some really interesting conversations, I think, to be had around that. But that sort of slowing down, and I guess some of the compassion that comes with that as well. And you've talked about compassionate practice. I think that's that compassion and that reconnection and just seeing people as human beings. I think that's just been such a good thing that's come out of this experience.
Yeah, it's lovely. I was talking to somebody on Twitter earlier. I don't know him, just a gentleman that I'm connected with on Twitter. And he'd said, please, I really don't want to go back to my 3-hour commute.
Yeah.
I'm working at home. I work on the cloud. There's no reason. And his employer had responded and said, we think, basically the exchange was about how they've also thought, we don't have to pay these really expensive premises. So hopefully some of those connections will be made. Like, actually, this is beneficial to everyone, not just one partner of that partnership. So I think there's lots of hope there for new normals.
Yeah, I don't know if you found as well that I'm really enjoying kind of reconnecting with people as well. It's, you know, by not being able to sort of physically see people, the amount of Skype calls and house parties, it's just been lovely to chat to people. And, you know, everyone's, and the question now is not like, how are you? It just feels like, are you well? Like people generally well and are taking the time to listen. And
we're asking, how are you? And we mean, how are you? And then,
yeah.
We're listening to the answer, aren't we? And I think it's interesting, isn't it? It feels like, because you mentioned that there, it feels also that we're seeing a really positive side of technology. Its power to actually help with connection, you know, because sometimes people can be like, oh, you know, social media is horrible and this and that and the other. But actually, we've been pushed towards finding useful ways of using it and useful ways of connecting. For some, I mean, I know not everybody's finding it that easy. Just a last couple of things. I've been asking everyone, because my friend told me to keep this jar. You've probably heard me say this. Mm. And she said, can you put in the jar, I think of it as Pandora's jar that she had said in the story. But she said, if you put in the jar, every time you think of something that you can't do at the moment that you want to do, and she was just said, oh, she found it really nice because it made her think about actually what she wanted to do, and none of the things were particularly grand or amazing. And I just wondered first, Lucy, if you, what might be in your jar of things that you've missed that you haven't been able to do?
Stroke animals. So I'm not sure whether you're meant to do it or not, so I haven't been. So when I've gone for walks, I haven't stroked any dogs. I've said hello, but I've not stroked them, or any cats. So that would be the first thing I'd put in, I think.
I think that's wise. I have also not been stroking.
No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, stroking animals.
I'm finding that difficult, though.
Oh, it's so hard.
Socially distancing from little joyful animals. It's difficult to test.
Is there anything else, or is that the sort of main strokey? No, you're allowed to just have that.
It was my first thought.
Yeah.
I'm really missing, not like pubs or big groups of people. I think what I've really missed is just a conversation in person, even if it's just one-to-one. And I'm really looking forward to just sitting in the same room as other people.
That's so
the conversation
nice.
Would be like an extra good thing, but even just to sit in the same space, I think I'd really enjoy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's lovely. That's going to feel such a treat, isn't it? So rich.
Yeah.
That's really. And what about you, Antonia?
I feel like I'm really missing the opportunity to go to a big open space, like go to the sea or go for a walk in the hills, and just to that view going on and on and on, and just to breathe in that, that openness. I'm very lucky where I am that I've got two really lovely parks quite close, which are beautiful at the moment, but there is just something about the sea, looking at that horizon and just drinking it in. A trip to the seaside is definitely on the cards as soon as I'm able. So,
oh, that's lovely. Yeah, me too. That's definitely all of the things you've said. And lastly, just to remind everybody that's listening about your show and your expertise, just before we talk about where people can find you, if somebody was listening and they were like, actually, I agree with you, I'm really scared of death and I don't like thinking about it, but I don't think I'm going to make a show about it. do you have any advice, perhaps Lucy first, about just a first sort of step towards slightly alleviating that fear or anxiety around death? and not necessarily being more positive about it, but just what advice might you give to sort of start making it less terrifying?
It's a good question. There's so many resources online and books and different places to find information that any one of those would be good. And attending an online or in-person death cafe might be a good place to start that. But I appreciate that might feel quite a large step. I don't know. I think finding a right moment, maybe not in the middle of a pandemic, I don't know, but to ask someone you care about what they might like and to have a think for yourself as well. And yeah, maybe note down a couple of things that would be important for that person, for yourself to have at your own funeral, and use that as a bit of a gateway.
I think that's lovely because it's doable, isn't it? It's not like, it's still a big question, but it feels really achievable for me anyway, when that conversation's a hard one to start, isn't it?
It's a more practical approach, which somehow feels a little bit more accessible, maybe, if you're a pragmatist.
Yeah, and I would say that by you offering that to the person you're talking to, it might make them feel more comfortable to then carry on that conversation as well. Because I think to ask someone, oh, have you thought about your funeral, just out of the blue? Yeah, it might be a bit much for some people, but to say, oh, you know, I love that song. I'd love that to be played at my funeral. It maybe brings it back down to being a bit more human. Yeah.
Yeah, simple, lovely. And if people would like to see the show or connect with you or find you on the internet, or where's the best place for that?
So probably the best place is our website, which is thedeathshow.co.uk. And there are production photos on there from our show, a trailer. We're not touring the show, obviously, at the moment. But we've also created a little podcast as well called The Death Show Podcast, where we've had conversations with quite a range of different people about death. And that's on all the podcast platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify and things like that, but all the details are on our website. So
brilliant, excellent. So that's the first stop, really, and then everything can come from there. Sorry, Lucy, you were going to say something then.
After saying that Japanese word that I couldn't remember what it was, I found it, but I don't know how to pronounce it, which is not good, is it? So for people who are just listening, I'm showing a picture of it written down. I don't know how you say that.
Could you spell it? My neighbour's Japanese, because I can ask her afterwards to say it.
It's IKIGAI.
Lovely.
And it's a fusion between what you love, what you're good at, what you can be paid for, what the world needs. So it's about passion, mission, vocation and profession.
Mm. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So I shall, after I've spoken with you two lovelies, I'll go next door and I'll ask Mickey to say that. And then we'll all know.
Brilliant.
And she might say, it doesn't mean that, Bernadette. It means bum, dirty bum or something. And then we'll know.
We'll check it out, because I don't want it tattooed on my face until I know.
Yeah. No. You don't want a tattooed dirty bum on your face.
No.
Okay. So lovely to see you both.
Oh,
and yeah, you.
Back to you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much. And I'll speak to you soon.
Thanks, Bernadette.
I asked my Japanese friend, I think you pronounce the word aikagai. And she told me it was a beautiful, beautiful word, a concept, a Japanese concept, which means to have a reason for being, which refers to having a direction or a purpose in life, finding something which makes one's life worthwhile and towards which we as individuals can take willing, spontaneous and hopeful actions to give ourselves a sense of meaning in life.
So maybe Aikagai is actually a shield that we can use in the face of the inevitability of death. I hope you enjoyed listening. Thank you very much. And just before I go, I was reminded of the Edvard Munch quote, which I really love and kind of connects the conversation that we were having a little bit at the end about the hopefulness in nature and the hopefulness of nature's resilience even in the face of death. And the quote is, in my rotting body flowers shall grow, and I am in them, and that is eternity. And I love that quote, and I find that immensely comforting, that life goes on. Flowers grow through concrete, tree roots break through pavements, and life goes on.